in life that you can stop, and there's certain things in life that can't be stopped. Let's go.
Welcome everyone to the Final Play Podcast. As each week we've been doing the last 3 or 4 weeks, fourth week we're on now, we're talking about, I don't know, to me probably one of the best documentaries I've seen for an NBA documentary, at least for quite a while, The Last Dance.
Well, yeah, well, when it's stretched out for 10 episodes and
you think
there's going to be a lot of juicy stuff in it too. So, you know, there's plenty of info and plenty of stuff that you know, we knew and planned. Then there's tons of stuff that's come out that we didn't know. So, you know, especially in this episode or these two episodes. So, it's been super interesting. Like I said, in the very first pod that we did of this, I was a Chicago Bulls fan for 3 years, and that was the three glorious years that Dennis Rodman was there. That was it.
No, I can't say. Yeah, no, you've never been a glory hound. I'll safely say you've never been a glory hound. You've been a glory hound for Dennis Rodman, but that's about it.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%. I'll totally freely admit to that.
So did you actually follow this person? I never asked that before.
Briefly, like that was when I started to really delve into the NBA. Was the start of his tenure at the Spurs, and you sort of had to, you know, read up in magazines back then about his days at the Pistons. These strange publications called magazines. That you used to stand in the newsagent and read and not actually buy.
You want to start us off with episode 7 then?
Well, I guess it had a sort of an interesting and very quick start, I suppose. It was their pre playoff press conference. Jerry Krause is sort of answering a few questions and one reporter comes out and says, you know, is there backstabbing going on here? They had to go through a lot of adversity, this 97-98 Bulls team. You know, all the speculation behind Michael, all the stuff that happened with Scottie Pippen at the start of the season. Dennis Rodman coming off the 96-97 season, not playing that great, coming off the big suspension. After kicking the cameraman, supposedly in the groin area, which I'm very, very debated about that he actually kicked him right in that area. I thought he missed, but anyway, not a Dennis Rodman homer at all.
I think
he got nowhere near that guy's nuts.
I think that, but I think people, I'd agree with that, but I think people took it off the guy's facial expression, which I have no problem with his facial expression.
The guy takes 3 seconds to react. He knows that everybody's there and everybody's watching him, and then realizes it's Dennis Rodman and goes, oh my God, he just hit me in the balls. He gets stretched off. He gets stretched off the court. Give me a break. Stretch it off. I get it. You cop one in the nuts. You have a nice few deep breaths, and then you're cool. You know, you're cool. You sit down and keep doing your job. You don't get stretched off the court. Like, what a bunch of BS. Anyway, so when somebody comes out and says, no, there's no backstabbing going on in this organization and with this team, there is 100% backstabbing going on with this organization and this team. And Jerry Krause gets pretty angry at the questions and then just storms out. And then we sort of have our first rewind of episode 7, where they rewind to basically straight after the 93 finals, where they beat Phoenix in 6 games. And then they start to say that basically he knew, like MJ knew that he was done.
He just looked physically exhausted.
He was stuffed. He was completely and utterly just out of energy.
He didn't. Again, talking about back to facial expressions, it's almost a blank look. It's like he lost a little bit of love for the game too. Just the snippets that they showed. I'm sure there's a lot more of it as well out there. But yeah, he just looked physically exhausted, or maybe not even physically, because then he went. We'll talk about it in a second. Went and played baseball. Sorry, but. Yeah, he just seemed like he. I think he's probably just had enough of the whole everybody coming down.
Just his possibly. Existence, and then you know all the stuff with all the gambling, and everybody. Everybody's looking to vilify him, and everybody's looking for the bad things now, the gambling and all the sorts of, you know, stuff like that, and you're just like, oh my god, like just. Yeah, it's you know, like they always have. You know, the heroes always, you know, they get torn down as a hero. You live to be a hero or you die a villain. Like it just, and that's sort of what it feels like. And as they say, yeah, he knew he was done, or not so much done, but he was very much thinking about, you know, throwing it all away after the second championship in 1992. But he wanted to do the Dream Team. And he basically wanted to best, you know, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson by winning a third title, which was something that those two had never done. They'd never done a three-peat. So that was something that sort of gave him that little bit of, you know, a little bit of edge and spurred him on, I guess, a little bit.
It spurred him on. I mean, do we want to talk about the... So, yeah, look, he looked effectively done, and he even came out, obviously, there was about 1,000, I counted about 150 to 200 people in that press conference when he was there, which is absolutely ridiculous for one person. So he obviously announced that he was retiring. Do we want to talk about the
thing was though, like he doesn't actually announce the retirement until October. So the season is just about, you know, that 93-94 season is just about to start.
Yeah.
And he hasn't given any indication or anything to the team that, you know, that he's done. And he's that off season, you know, once they won the championship and it was only about 2 months later. So yeah, as they start to do the deep dive in this episode is obviously the death of his father, James Jordan.
James Jordan, yeah.
As you sort of when they do the investigation of it, and it's, I mean the stuff that I sort of remember from it was very vague because we're obviously in a different country, it's a different age. You only hear bits and pieces of what you get. Maybe get in the news, and where you used to get your everybody sports, analysis and everything was on Good Old Sports Tonight on Channel 10. If you're lucky enough, if you're lucky enough to stay up that late. that's what I remember getting all the latest NBA scores was Sports Tonight.
Sports Tonight with Dad. Big head Tim someone. Oh, yeah,
Tim,
my God.
Yeah, but Tim Webster.
Tim Webster, that's it. Oh, my God. That's going way back. I remember sitting up so late.
It was after the news. It was brutal. It was like 11 o'clock. And it's like, oh, my God, I just got to get a bed. Anyway, so they dive into it. And as they go through the events of everything happening, his father goes down to North Carolina. He doesn't get in contact with everybody. He actually goes missing for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So, you know, people start to get a little bit worried. And then all of a sudden it comes out on the news that his car was found all busted up. It was found in a creek August 13th, 1993. So it would have been about 2 months after they'd had the third championship. He was found in the car, two shots to the chest. So not so much an assassin like, you know, killing, but yeah, it was essentially a robbery gone bad. They'd arrested two 18-year-olds. It was basically an armed robbery gone bad. Which is really unfortunate, and the way that off season went, as they go into it, the MJ says the last conversation that he actually has with his dad before he goes back down to North Carolina was a debate about playing baseball. That was the last conversation that he had, not so much an argument, but they were debating whether or not he should pursue going to baseball. As they go through it the funeral happens in Wilmington, North Carolina, and as they go through it, and his mum's trying to be as positive as possible, be thankful, even on a day like this, be thankful, try and turn a negative into a positive. That was pretty much the straw that broke the camel's back. And in a couple of months, he's having the press conference, the famous press conference that he said he's going to retire from the game of basketball, basically with no more challenges left in the game. He thinks he's conquered everything that he thinks he can. Scoring champion, MVP, three championships. He's done it all. Defensive player of the year, slam dunk champion.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people didn't realize how, like, James Jordan was always there.
He was there with him everywhere.
Yeah. It didn't sort of seem like maybe people's perception of it. It didn't seem to me that people didn't realize how much of a hit that took of him, like that he probably liked him having always by his side. It was like he always asked him questions, and like a father figure would be.
It was his best friend, not so much his father, but it was his best friend. And there would be certain nights where they would just be cooped up in a hotel room or in his apartment somewhere with just him and his dad, and they'd be playing dominoes, playing cards, just doing things like that, because MJ was so famous that it didn't matter where he went, he would just be hounded by the media and by people and paparazzi and all that sort of stuff, and it was just good to have that little bit of quiet time, and that's who he liked to spend time with his father.
Did you think he was going to go to baseball, in all honesty?
Absolutely not. When you heard the press conference that come out, and that was obviously big news back in the day as well, that the game's best player is essentially retiring, at a fairly early age too. He was only 32. He had no more challenges. He feels that he had conquered everything. That there was to conquer in the NBA, and look, baseball was his first love with his father. So he absolutely, now that he's gone, he's like, no, that's it. And for me, I think that was a coping mechanism for him, was to completely get out of his comfort zone, not just to stay in the NBA, but to just completely get out of his comfort zone and to give baseball a real shot.
Do you? We'll have to talk about him because I guess they were sort of out there. Do you buy into any of the conspiracy sort of theories that were out there about or anything about why he did leave? Like he was sort of there was a conspiracy one, like he was pushed out. Basically,
well, not so much that he was. I think the media and not so much the fans, but I think the media did a pretty good job of trying to push him out of the game. But yeah, the conspiracy theory of this is a suspension from David Stern to Michael Jordan over sort of essentially bringing the game into disrepute over his alleged gambling and everything like that. And no, I'm not. Well, why on earth would you let your biggest and best superstar that is just the absolute cash cow of your league.
Yeah.
Why would you suspend? Why would you let him walk? Why would you suspend him? He is an he's the NBA is was going to be just fine without him. That's fine, but why would you do that? Like that doesn't make any sense. I get the conspiracy theory behind it, but that's crazy talk.
Like like one of the guys I guess that was on there basically said it's total bullshit.
Yeah, that's for exactly, two reasons. How do I put this discreetly?
For two reasons.
Exactly what it was.
For two reasons, I think. If there was ever the case, I mean, this they would have known this back then, but if it was ever the case that Jordan was going to be an NBA owner, there would be no way that if he had this gambling, you know, thing over him, there's no way he would have been an owner. The owners they would have found that out and they would have, you know, there would have been, they probably would have voted against him. Plus, I don't think David Stern, who I have always remember as the ultimate, like, he capitalized, like he brought NBA into the world pretty much, if you know what I mean. Right. So why would he take out the number one player in the number one franchise that was going back then, which basically would have lowered the value of all the leagues, all the NBA teams in the league. That's I never bought into anything. I just literally just thought he just wanted a break. Honestly, I didn't think he would go to baseball, to be quite honest. I thought he may come back, but I didn't think he'd go to baseball. I didn't think that was going to happen.
Not a lot of stuff was sort of said about that, when the news come across that he was actually going to retire, he was actually at a baseball game. He was at the Chicago White Sox. He was at a playoff game for the White Sox, and he was at a suite. And then all of a sudden it started to come out that tomorrow. And that ended up being, I think that was on the 5th of October, so tomorrow, the 6th of October, 1993, that he was going to come out and hold a press conference that he was going to retire. So it was just funny that that he happened to be at a baseball game when he's going to the next day he's going to have a press conference and retire from the league and essentially go to baseball.
Yeah, there was with the baseball. He did obviously have some, I guess, criticism at the start, purely because not by the fans. The fans absolutely loved him. The fans were everywhere, and he knew it was going to happen when he went down to that Double-A for Alabama, like Chicago White Sox, B grade team or G League team, if you want to call it in the NBA terms of it.
They were a Double-A team. Yeah, the Birmingham Barons.
But a lot of, despite the criticism, like he did sort of start shining through towards the end there. When he, a lot of people, like old coaches and all that, they really thought if he stuck with it and had 3 years, they had no doubt in their mind that he would have been in the major league baseball, the MLB.
Oh, absolutely. And like they say, like they said at the start of it, I can't remember who was the baseball writer that was assigned to write for, you know, essentially to follow Michael Jordan around with the Birmingham Barons. It's just that people forget that he actually went, you know, when he first started, he went on a 13 game hit streak. Like that's amazing for somebody who's just come back out and had one full off season of training and skills testing, and then it starts to go a little bit sour after that. You know, he's missing breaking balls by a foot. So all of a sudden it's like, righto, you know, we know exactly how to pitch to him. You know, no more fastballs down the middle. You know, we'll get him out. He's just swinging at everything. He's just hacking away like a blind woodsman with an axe. Yeah, he's just swinging at everything, which is I think the fascination about it is if you're first coming into baseball, and you just want to swing at everything.
Yeah, so, of course.
That's right.
Not that we know much about baseball, but as a normal person, that's what I would do. You'd be swinging at everything.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You'd be hacking at everything. So yeah, that's just what happens, and you know, the error started to creep in. He's striking out a lot. But by the end of it, by the end of the season, he's actually hitting 202. Like, his average was 202. And a lot of people were super surprised at that, that he actually averaged, 202. And he had 50 RBIs.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, you know, for a guy who's just walked in, essentially, and yes, he's a great athlete, but, you know, those numbers, they're not bad.
I think it wasn't even that. It was obviously that, because that's just Michael Jordan. He was always just a competitor. That was just his MO. But I also took out of that he just wanted to be not Michael Jordan, just wanted to be one of the boys.
It's the 30 for 30 that Jordan rides the bus. Like, and that's that's essentially what he wanted to do. He just wanted to. Yeah, he just wanted to be a regular. Just wanted to be a regular guy. Like, and that's impossible for somebody of his stature. But he tried it.
He did try.
To be an average person. Do you know what I mean? Yes. Not the biggest superstar in the game. Not the best player in the game. Not the face of a franchise in a league. Just to be Michael Jordan, average baseball player.
Probably one of the biggest one of the biggest people in the world, literally. So it wasn't just basketball. Yeah. Like, everybody knew Michael Jordan. So
yeah, right. Influential in pop culture, sport, everything.
Everything. Then they flash back to the 93-94 season where the Bulls were playing. They were playing well without Jordan because Pippen was coming into his own finally.
Essentially, he stepped out of Michael Jordan's shadow, didn't he? He'd been there his whole career. You know, he was drafted in 87. You know, he'd always been there with Michael. That year, I think he averaged like 22 points a game. Was third in MVP voting. A lot of people are saying that once Michael left, that I think it was Dennis Rodman might have even said that. He said Scottie Pippen was the best player in the league when Michael those one and a bit seasons that Michael wasn't there, he was the best player in the league. And, like I said, I'm a Dennis Rodman homer, but I find that highly offensive to players like Akeem Olajuwon and David Robinson and Karl Malone and Charles Barkley and people like that. I find that highly offensive for him to say that. He's got the relationship with Scottie Pippen, I know, and Scottie Pippen does a lot of intangibles and things like that. But when he said that, I found that highly offensive. The first person that popped into my mind was Hakeem Olajuwon. Like, that's extremely offensive to Hakeem Olajuwon.
Well, because he got the MVP that season, then Hakeem. That was his NBA.
Pretty sure. 93-94 season he did.
It was also the rookie season or rookie year for a young Tony Kukoc was having a hell of a good season in that.
Kukoc had finally made his way to America after being drafted in 1990, and this was his first season in 93-94. Had himself another three and a bit years playing in Europe. And I think the team didn't really miss a beat. Like, instead of having that, not so much dictatorship of Michael Jordan, but, you know, that hard edge of Michael Jordan. Like, he didn't really care about people's feelings or anything like that, whereas Scottie Pippen was more of a pick-me-up kind of person and, you know, was a little bit more compassionate towards teammates and things like that and like to put his arm around them and sort of give them comfort and to sort of pick them up a little bit, you know, rather than sort of yell at them and do all sorts of, you know, crazy insulting things to them like you did with poor old Scotty Burrell.
It is interesting you're saying that, but, you know, segueing into what happened in that season. Like, they got to the playoff, they swept the Cavaliers, like just smashed the Cavaliers in the first round. But then they come up against the New York Knicks. This was the New York Knicks of Patrick Ewing and that's the first one.
John Starks, Charles Smith.
They were
a powerhouse. Like, I mean, if you don't remember that 93-94 season, the New York Knicks made the NBA Finals. They were one hell of a team. And once again, a hard nose, you know, beat you down, smash you up kind of team.
And, not the greatest team on paper, but they were like the Detroit Pistons. They had a great player. They had one or two great players, but they beat you down. They wore you down. They got in your head, kind of team.
That's right. So, yeah, exactly. And as it sort of progresses on, the story which I found extremely surprising as they tell it. It comes down to the last play. I think it's 92-91. It comes down to the last play. There's only about 7 seconds left on the clock. So Phil calls a timeout, gets everybody in the huddle, and draws up a play. He doesn't draw up a play for Scottie Pippen. He draws up a play for Tony Kukoc, which, as they show, four times during the season that this play had worked on buzzer beaters for Tony Kukoc. So he draws up the play again for Tony Kukoc. Doesn't sit very well with Scottie Pippen. Let's just say that. Scottie Pippen has, I guess, would you say a bit of a, I would just say a straight up sulk on the bench.
Straight up sulk.
Yeah. Doesn't he want to go in? Doesn't he want to go in the game? Like, he was going to be the one that's inbounding the ball. He doesn't even want to be on the court for this play. And you see Bill Cartwright, he's sort of putting his arm around him and trying to pick him up a little bit and say, look, it's cool. We're all about the wins here. We're not about, individual accolades or anything like that. So the play actually comes off. Like, that was an unbelievably tough shot that Kukoc makes with a hand in his face, and granted, Tony Kukoc was 6'10", but just an unbelievably tough shot. And Kukoc wins that. I think it was game one of that Eastern Conference semifinals. And it even carries on into the locker room, if you remember.
It did, but it's funny. As soon as that happened, I went straight on Twitter just to sort of see, because obviously Twitter goes crazy when The Last Dance is going on. Like, it's absolutely insane, which is for obvious reasons. But there was a tweet that came out. It's basically, and it must be high. Again, we didn't realize it, but it must be high on Bulls fans' minds, because a tweet came out basically said, ask a Bulls fan to tell you how much time was left for Paxson's shot in 93 or Jordan's shot in 98, and you'll get a shrug. But ask them how much time was left when Pippen sat out, and they all say 1.8 seconds. So they knew exactly. So that, yeah, which is very interesting. But as you were alluding to, there was Bill Cartwright.
I guess a locker room leader besides Scottie Pippen on that team. He was an elder statesman of the team, so I guess he was sort of, besides Scottie Pippen, I guess he was sort of the heart and soul of that team.
He had this heartfelt speech, which obviously we don't know what happened, but he, he started crying and just, told Pippen just to show, he showed him the error of his ways.
Basically said to him, I can't believe you quit on us.
Yeah. Yep.
I can't believe you quit on us. In not so many words. Like, that's a pretty tough thing to sort of say to somebody after you've just won the game. You think that it should be sort of celebratory in the locker room, but it sort of turns into a little bit of not so much doom and gloom, but it turns into sort of a somber locker room after a game one, a tough four game one win.
I don't know. Like, what is your perception of the moment? I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of positives for him, but there's a little bit of a perception to me, or for me at least, between this and then the injury where he had the surgery at the start of the season, is perception of Scottie Pippen that he wasn't really a good teammate, which, I'm only going off this. I know he was a great teammate. You can ask, well, Jordan said it himself. When you say Michael Jordan, you say Scottie Pippen. So, there's that little bit of perception. Like, if you were a casual fan, that's what I would perceive that as, that he sulked in that bit, and then he also then Well, I didn't sulk, like, but he, I guess in a way he did sulk that, you know, by having the surgery during the season, which is unheard of generally for any player.
No, that's right. No, that's right.
So, you're right.
I just think that, yeah, I guess, like you said, yeah, there's that little bit of perception out there. Yeah, he's just had the best season of his career, essentially. Yeah, with it, yeah, like we said, yeah, stepping out of the shadows of Michael Jordan, but and he feels that his time is now. He feels that it's his team now. This is my team. You know, Phil Jackson would have drawn up a play for Michael Jordan in that sense. So why isn't he trusting in me? Why isn't he drawing up this play for me, Scottie Pippen? I'm the man of this team now. Yeah. This is my team now. So, you know, I get it in both ways, but for just, yeah, to have just a complete sort of breakdown and to not even go in the game, I think is a little bit of a slight on Scottie Pippen. But, and even in the interview that he says during it, and as he watches it again, and he even says, I wouldn't do anything different. If that situation had come to me again, I wouldn't do anything different. So he still feels fairly strongly about it, even to this day, that he wasn't called upon to be the man.
Yeah. And okay, but I don't know. And I get it. Don't get me wrong. He was having an MVP season. You know, he had this. He was clearly the best player on that on that Bulls side, but. I don't know. Knowing Phil, yes, you're right. He would have drafted that up for Jordan, so why wouldn't he draft it up for Pippen? But no, then exactly. Phil, but I just, Phil, I don't know. Just Phil, it's Phil. Phil, yeah.
Phil's about getting the W and not fueling people's egos. That's what Phil Jackson's about.
Yeah.
He's about getting the win. This play has worked for us before.
Yeah.
We're going to live and die. You know, we're going to roll with it. You know, Tony Kukoc is a rookie, all well and good. He's already had 4 years of professional ball in Europe, so he's not really a rookie, but he's a rookie in the NBA. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that sort of has something to do with it as well, he's just like, he's going to go to this rook and not me. Like, like I said, you know, he believes, and he was the man of that team. So you put the ball in my hands. I'm going to win this game, not anybody else.
And clearly, at the end of the day, you know, while he got the game winner, it didn't really make a difference in the end. Like you said before, the Knicks then, you know, get into the finals, unfortunately losing for the Knicks. Probably would have been, yeah, I don't know. Just before we move on, just the Knicks, that was their best. That 93, I just remember that was their best chance of getting that NBA title in the modern era. So,
but they made the most of Michael not being there. At least they made the NBA finals.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that series against Houston goes to game 7 and they run into there. They run into a Houston Rockets team who was obviously equally as good, but just that little bit better. Yeah.
Then they sort of flash forwarded back to 98, I believe. It was the Bulls against the Hornets.
Well, it's, yeah, as episode 7 sort of winds up, they flash forward to back to April of 98. You know, Jordan's having a good old joke. Once again at Scotty Burrell's expense. He has a couple of mates that come up from Connecticut. As he's talking to them, and I'm pretty sure Scotty Burrell went to UConn. I've sort of heard afterwards as well. So, yeah, you look up Scotty Burrell. He was drafted by the Toronto Blue Jays. He was a pitcher. Yeah. Like he could have absolutely made it as a major league pitcher. Instead, you know, he was drafted in 93 by the Hornets. Makes his way to Chicago via sort of multiple trades. I think he got traded from Charlotte to Golden State, and then from Golden State to Chicago in the start of that 97 season. I think it was for Dickie Simpkins. I don't know why that name sticks in my head, but pretty sure it was for Dickie Simpkins that he got traded there for. Anyway, He's sort of having a bit of a joke with him and his few friends that he had in the locker room, and makes a joke that oh, I hear UConn has a really good women's team, and they all sort of laugh about that. And then as they sort of flash to Michael Jordan, and he essentially comes out and says, look, you know, but winning has a price, and being a leader has a price. So I think that sort of resonates a little bit with Scottie Pippen. In that regard. And then he gets super emotional and choked up. And pretty much says, look, you know, this is how I am. This is who I am.
Yeah.
If you don't want to play that way, don't play that way. And then there's this sort of a little bit of uncomfortable pause, and then he says break. And then you can just see that he's welling up a little bit.
Yeah. But he also did say, you know, if you ask all his teammates, the one thing about Michael Jordan was he never asked me, and this is Scotty Burrell coming out and said it, he never asked me to do anything that he didn't want to do.
He wasn't willing to do himself.
Correct.
That's right.
So maybe he wasn't a nice guy. This is what I remember Scotty Burrell saying. Maybe he wasn't a nice guy. Maybe he was a bit of a prick. But like I said, I've been saying to everybody, he might be a prick to them, but he's a prick that won them rings too, because no one else would have won them that many rings. So
no, that's right.
You know, they wanted to win, and that was how they had to win.
And that's how you had to do it.
Then we roll on to episode 8, which, yeah, like we say, we were talking about, it was starting in the Bulls had won game one against the Charlotte Hornets team with ex-Bulls player in BJ Armstrong, who was playing for then Charlotte, obviously.
That's right. Well, that's right. Charlotte didn't have a too bad a team. I was a bandwagoner with the Chicago Bulls and Dennis Rodman, but I always loved my Charlotte Hornets back in the day. And they didn't really have a bad team. You know, BJ Armstrong, Glenn Rice, Vlade Divac. They didn't have a bad David Wesley, like they didn't have a bad team at all in that 97-98 season.
Yeah, I remember. And unfortunately, sorry, you go.
Oh no, it's me. Yeah, I was a massive Charlotte Hornets fan. You know, give me the days of you know the best trio to never really do anything, in Larry Johnson, Alonzo Mourning, and Muggsy Bogues. Like, yeah, they achieved, you know, absolutely nothing as a trio. You know, they were very, you know, Larry Johnson was the showman and you know, Muggsy Bogues was the backbone and the talent was Alonzo Mourning, but you know, they really didn't have a whole lot to show for it. I think it was one playoff series win, they just achieved nothing before essentially they all broke up and moved it on to other teams.
I just remember you were a big Glenn Rice fan. That's what I was going to say.
Oh, I love Glenn Rice. When he came across from the Heat to the Charlotte Hornets, man, I thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, I'd moved on from Alonzo Mourning and Larry Johnson. I'd forgotten about them. It's like, no, we got Glenn Rice now. We're good.
Oh man, he had such a sweet shot too at that 3-point line.
Oh, he was, and the thing was, in that 97-98 season, the season before, he'd come off an All-Star Game MVP, Glenn Rice.
His first
year with the Charlotte Hornets. Like he was just starting to really fit in it there in Charlotte. But yeah, as we sort of go on back onto this, BJ Armstrong essentially sort of comes out and says that you know, I have the key to beating these Bulls. You know, I've been on that team. I know how to beat them. And he comes out and they go through the game a little bit, and Charlotte are actually putting up a good fight and they're winning. And he comes, they draw up the play at the end of the game, and he comes off a pick and roll and essentially supposedly beats Michael Jordan, but he kind of doesn't, because he comes off a pick and roll with Vlade Divac. So it's just like, he didn't beat Michael Jordan one-on-one. He gets the pick. So, you know, if that's how you want to say that he beats him, then, you know, more power to you.
That's right. But,
yeah, and he hits the big shot. They go, I think they go up five, and he is just talking smack. He's talking,
Jordan,
he's talking to the bench, and he is just in the moment. It's in Chicago. He is just absolutely just blowtorching everybody that's wearing white and red numbers, like just blowtorching them.
And it just
shows the competitor that Mike is, that's all he needed.
Yeah.
And I remember from then, it's just like, yeah, nah, they wiped them out in the next three games. They ties the series at 1-1, and it's just like, this is bad. This is such a bad idea, and it was the worst mistake that BJ Armstrong could have done.
Well, that's all they needed. He just needed that. He said, that's all I needed when we were talking about just before the pod. He just needs that one little thing. George Karl walking past him, not even saying, no, acknowledging him. He said, yep, all right. That's where we're going to play it.
Yep.
That's
yep.
All he
that's how we're going to do this. Yeah, that's it. Seattle, you are screwed.
My God, it was just, yeah.
And it was just funny that the quote that he sort of says as they're running the tape, it's not an interview. It's just, they're training. They go back to training the next day. Basically he's just saying, yeah, it's easy to talk shit when you're winning. Like, it's easy to do that when you're winning. How about you come at me and talk a little bit of shit when it's 0-0, you know, or you're behind. Then they proceed to wipe Charlotte off the face of the planet. And then they go, they win that series 4-1. But I guess it's sort of an insight into, you know, ex players. Mm-hmm. As we'll sort of move on to the next ex-player, as they rewind back to 1995, and the next ex-player, which is Horace Grant.
Yeah.
Essentially, the Bulls didn't want to pay him, so he leaves and he goes to the Orlando Magic.
Yeah. Just before that bit, before we talk about Orlando, do you think, while Jordan was practicing with the Bulls, do you think that, it's just really good timing for the Bulls that MLB was on a strike at that time and they refused to play, he refused to play in those replacing games. Having the MLB on strike, you know, that's such a good thing for the NBA, you know, to get him back, I think. I don't know, I remember when they were on strike at that time, or I looked it up, I should say, they were on strike at that 95, so he started training, and obviously then he got the love for it back again.
No, that's right. Yeah, he refused to play in those replacements. He wanted to get there on his own merit. He didn't want to be, he didn't want to be a charity case. He wanted to play in the majors against major league players, not against other replacement players. So I guess he sort of felt the need to come out and do that. And like you said, he sort of. Him and BJ Armstrong are pretty close. So, he meets up with BJ Armstrong for lunch. They go, it's late in the year, in the NBA calendar year. They go into a training facility. They start playing a little bit of one-on-one ball. This is in 1995. They start playing a little bit of one-on-one ball. They realize that, Mike, Mike's still Mike, he's still all right. So he proceeds to start to roll up to Bulls practices. And I guess that sort of gets the juices flowing a little bit. And, I totally remember this, but it used to be, I guess it's still on now, the old TV show, NBA Action. And that was that's where you used to get all of your your half an hour's worth of NBA for the week.
That was, best half an hour ever.
And it's the famous Scottie Pippen wearing the Jordan 10s with the Jordan logo on the bottom, and Scottie Pippen doing the comeback symbol with his finger pointing at it, come back, and that's in March 1995.
And they were struggling too that season.
They were. That's right. They were barely above 500.
Yeah.
When Michael actually comes back, against and it just sort of has that flow on effect from there. Jordan comes back, he calls his agent, and he's like, I'm ready to come back. I'm ready to come back. I think I'm ready for it. And then it was the once again, the famous fax that comes back, and he tries to put it into words. You know, how is he going to do this? How is he going to come back? And it's just two words. I'm back. And that's it. And then as we go on, it's March 18, 1995. He comes back. The Bulls are struggling. They're 34-31. They're only three games above 500.
Yes.
You know, they're teetering to just make the playoffs. So that's it. Michael's back. So the next day is March 19, 1995, against Indiana.
Yeah.
In Market Square Arena. Yeah, he's nervous, and the thing, you know, his dad's not there for the first time.
Yeah. Wasn't having a great shooting game, really.
Oh, no, no, God, no. He goes 7-28.
Yeah.
Like, he's just 7-28.
Yeah.
And the thing that's the most strange about it is he's wearing the number 45.
It is, yeah. Why do you think that was strange? Just because, like,
You're so accustomed to him.
Yeah.
To wearing the famous 23, and, you know, not only makes the Jordan brand shoes and everything, he makes the number 23 the most famous number in sports.
In general, it is. It's not even in sports. It's one of the most famous numbers ever.
Well, is anybody? You want to be 23.
If anyone talks about 23, they know it's associated with Michael Jordan. That's another thing that he's put in pop culture. But
that was his number in baseball, but as he says as well, that was the number that he wore in high school.
Yeah, that correct.
Was his first number in high school. So, you know, he sort of goes back to that. So, yeah, so unceremoniously he shoots 7-28, has 19 points in the comeback. You know, he sort of struggles a little bit.
It's a game winner.
They chronicle the next two games.
So they fast
forward. They go to March 25 against Atlanta, hits the buzzer beater. And yeah, the commentator is, you know, the commentator saying he is now back. This is Michael Jordan. He is back.
Mm.
So again, we fast forward three more days. We go to March 28 against the New York Knicks at Madison Square Garden, where, you know, Michael said in the last couple of episodes that that's his absolute favorite place to play besides the United Center. Proceeds to drop the famous double nickel game, the 55 points. Now, this is his fourth game back from retirement, and he just lights up the Knicks for 55 points.
It was 10 days in from a 21-month sabbatical, so to speak, if they call this what they're calling it. So it's it was unbelievable. It just
and they interview Patrick Ewing, and Patrick Ewing's just like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I had a good game in that. Yeah, you know, I'm pretty sure I had a really good game that as well. I think he says Pat has 38 points.
That's right. No one knew that.
Like, nobody's going to remember that because Michael has 55. What are you kidding?
He did also notice after that after that game, but his body wasn't accustomed to it was a baseball body. It wasn't accustomed to the rigors of NBA or basketball.
No, that's right. A lot more upper body strength that he sort of, you know, needed, and his lower body wasn't, you know, he just didn't have the legs under him.
Yeah. Getting on to when you were saying they did face a really good Chicago team, which, that team, if they stayed healthy and together, that team was ridiculous. Shaquille O'Neal, Penny Hardaway, Horace Grant, Nick Anderson was in there as well. Nick
Anderson, Dennis Scott. That Orlando team. And, you know, funnily enough, in that season, in 94-95, that Orlando Magic team makes the NBA Finals. So, you know, and then they get unceremoniously swept by the Houston Rockets. So, you know, as they, but it's in the second round, they play the Orlando Magic. Obviously there's a little bit of, you know, a little bit of niggle in that game. You know, Horace Grant you know, now playing for the Magic. It's game one. Yeah, Nick, Jordan's he's struggling a little bit, and they have the opportunity to actually win the game. And as the inbound comes in, Michael's dribbling up the court, and Nick Anderson just trails him and just gets the steal off him, like just no sweat, no nothing, just takes the ball straight, just comes and knocks the ball away from behind, and then you know at the end of the game, Michael, instead of taking the shot, he actually looks to pass, the ball goes out. And they end up losing the game. And Nick Anderson is quoted at the end of the game in the press conference, you know, playing 45. Well, it isn't 23, is it? So, what do you think happens? What do you think happens in game two?
In game two, Jordan went off.
He just goes ballistic. And funnily enough, he changes back to the number 23.
Yeah. He went off in that game too. He absolutely just, he just tore. I don't know. Like it was a game after that game too that I thought, okay, well, this is the Bulls and they're going to come back and, you know, see you later, Orlando Magic. Unfortunately, that didn't pan out like that.
No, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Magic ended up winning that series 4-2, and the clinching game was in Chicago, and yeah, I guess sort of the story goes, yeah, you see the images of everybody raising Horace Grant up on their shoulders and everything, and he's celebrating, you know, in non home colors, and yeah, I'm sure there would have been some profanities being screamed at him from the crowd. You know, disgruntled Chicago fans. And straight away after that, Michael is like, no off season. The very next day, we get back at it.
He knew, like his legs.
No off season. I don't care. We're back in the gym.
He was still baseball body ready. He wasn't basketball body ready. His legs were just, he was stuffed, basically.
But he was gassed already. He'd only played about 22 games and he was gassed already.
He said no, he's going to immediately back into get his body ready for next season, despite the fact he was filming a little known movie called Space Jam over the summer.
I don't know how did that movie go? Like I wasn't sure. I think that did all right, didn't it? Space Jam. I think it did all right.
I actually, funnily enough, I mean. Talk about like what happened with Warner Brothers, but I did have somewhere the budget was like next to nothing, but God damn, it made some money.
Oh, yeah.
It made some ridiculous amount of money. And this is the time when like having a Michael Jordan in a movie and Bill Murray. Bill Murray was massive too. Bill Murray wasn't a small actor, but yeah, so it was a budget of $80 million and I'm assuming, you know, two thirds of that went to Bill and Michael, and probably Larry had probably a little bit.
He might have a little bit. He didn't have that big a role in it, Larry.
No. End up making $250 million. So that's a pretty good return on a movie.
Good investment. Between
filming, Warner Brothers. So the movie was made at Warner Brothers, and Michael said he wanted to work out and play. He needed to get back to his body, like the body that he wanted, basically. So he and Warner Brothers, they accustomed to him, so they made him a full court and a gym, like just on the lot, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Just on the lot, just like right there. It's just like, there you go. Have at it.
So, well, I mean, like he was obviously the star of the movie. They must have thought it was going to be a massive movie. You know, it's
of course.
But you know, he asked. They did it. They probably didn't. By the looks of it, it wouldn't cost him an arm and a leg to do. Anyways, it's a bit of gym equipment and a basketball court. But it was just amazing to see. Not only for the fact to see a court that was on a Warner Brothers lot, but that a lot of players, current NBA players, were going to play pickup games with him.
No, that's right.
It was unbelievable the players were turning up. There was Reggie Miller. There was a Dennis Rodman. I've seen Patrick Ewing there.
Yeah, Patrick Ewing.
Magic Johnson, I'm sure I've seen there. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a nice little scouting tour. For Michael Jordan, I think. I think that was rather smart.
I think it was very smart of him. It was definitely a scouting tour. But Reggie, just remember coming out and saying he didn't know, he could not work out how he did it. He had to film.
Oh man, he just must have been a machine filming. Working out, getting training in, then working out again, then doing more filming. His days must have been massive.
So he said that they were playing until 9 and 10 at night time. They were playing for 3 hours. He had to still get up. He had to still get weightlifting in, and then call for the next day at 6 or 7 in the morning. So he said, dude was like a vampire.
So he turned into a vampire. What a machine.
You're right. I think that was just – he wanted to get his body ready, but it's definitely a scouting mission as well.
Oh, yeah. It was definitely a little scouting tour. That was quite good.
Obviously, by the time the camp started, he was in incredible shape. A lot of the
players. That's right. So – I guess we fast forward on to probably, I think, which is probably, the most famous Bulls team as they start the 95-96 season. It's essentially a new team, except for Michael and Scotty. It's a totally new team. As they roll on, and MJ's back in his ways again. You know, he's getting stuck into teammates and things like that, and you know, he wants to make it feel like that they're in a war and they're in the trenches, and this is going to toughen them up, and so they don't crack under the pressure when the real blowtorch is on, when you're in games, when you're in precious situations, he would just get stuck into teammates at training, and that sort of leads to the once again, as we keep saying, the famous stoush between himself and Steve Kerr.
A young Steve Kerr, current coach of the Golden State Warriors. Yeah, it was a little bit of a stoush. Like it was
it was interesting to get sort of both sides of the story.
That's exactly right. Basically, as far as it went down, Jordan got upset when Jackson was calling these ticky-tacky fouls on him while he was guarding Kerr. Jordan found him hard and said, "Now that's a effing foul," which prompted Kerr then to hit him in the chest. Jordan then hauled off and punched him right in the eye, which obviously forced Phil to kick him out of practice.
Yeah, he chucks him out of practice.
So, but obviously, Jordan.
Well, that's
Jordan.
What I mean. They patch things up. Like Jordan. Yeah. Jordan feels bad afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
He calls him up on the phone. Apologizes, and then from then, he essentially has, Steve Kerr didn't back down, and then he essentially has, he has Jordan's respect then, and that's what he wanted. That's what he wanted from everybody. You know, whether or not he pushed people too hard or not, but he just wanted He wanted to get the respect.
Yeah.
And that was just his way of doing it. He was a bit of a hard ass.
Yeah. Not many players liked him, but he got him rings. But goddamn, they started that season so well.
Oh man, they were just destroying everybody. Like just it was a league record then. It was 72-10. And the record of 69-13 by the Lakers was 28 years old until the Bulls had come through and done that. Everybody was just quivering at that Bulls team. Like they were just annihilating people. And once again, I'll say that one of those 10 losses was against the Charlotte Hornets. So. Yeah, Charlotte weren't so much of a pushover.
They then, obviously, coming off the 72-10 season, like you said, everyone was shitting themselves, especially the Magic. Magic, obviously, were riding high on that last time when they faced Jordan, I should say. But Chicago swept him in 4 games.
They rumbled through the Eastern Conference. They lost one game in the Eastern Conference playoffs. They wiped Miami off the floor 3-0. They lost one game to the Knicks, and then they swept the Magic. So it was not so much essentially a walk in the park for them to go. They were just such a good team that the Eastern Conference teams just didn't pose a threat to them at all. They just they obliterated the Eastern Conference. So they get to the NBA Finals and play George Karl's, Sean Kemp, Gary Payton, Hersey Hawkins, Detlef Schrempf.
Detlef Schrempf, yeah.
And the Seattle Supersonics.
The team that everybody wants back.
Oh, of course.
Every true NBA fan wants back, anyway. Yeah, that's another thing to talk about.
Nobody's buying this Oklahoma City rubbish.
There's a whole, I'll talk about it later. There's a whole conspiracy behind that too. But anyway, I'll digress away from that.
they face the Sonics. Yeah, like we said earlier, the story goes that. George Karl is walking through a restaurant. He sees Jordan and the Bulls and everything all sitting there, and not even acknowledgement, just walks straight past, gives them the brush, and Jordan's like, righto, cool, that's how you're gonna play it. Yeah, it's on.
Yeah, and it was on the first three games. They were 3-0 down.
They were up 3-0. They were up 3-0.
Yeah,
the Bulls.
The Sonics were 3-0 down. Those first three games, talking about Gary Payton, he was Defensive Player of the Year that year, hence the nickname The Glove. A glove. Like his hand would somehow attract to the ball when someone else had it. It was absolutely ridiculous.
He had a rubber magnet or something. Like he was crazy, man. It was one of the best defensive guards, in the league at the time, and probably one of the best defensive guards in NBA history. And boy, did he have a mouth on him.
He did have a mouth on him, but
he could back it up, and that's the thing. He could back it up.
Yeah. It is interesting though for those first three games though that George decided not to put Gary Payton onto Jordan in those first three games. Even though I guess Gary knew, he could make life hell for Jordan, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, as I said, all you got to do is tire him out, and then they have the interview with Gary Payton, and then they show that to Michael. And he just starts laughing. It's just like, oh no, the little idiosyncrasies that Gary Payton's saying, you just got to get your hands in there, and you've just got to tire him out, and you just got to bump him a little bit, and that's what you got to do, and it worked for two games. Those games 4 and 5 in Seattle, they won, and I think they won handsomely. They sent the series back to Chicago for the last two games, they show the interview, Michael's laughing, and then he just comes out and he's just like, I've got no problems with the glove, I've got no problems with him. He 100% earned his respect.
Because
he knew he was a hell of a defensive player.
He never said anything bad about him, not once during that night. He had that smile on his face, like I thought, oh my god, he's gonna say something like,
oh yeah, I thought he was gonna roast him.
The glove, huh?
He had a bit of a laugh, but reminisce and go back, I'll go back to that championship series, and I just did a little bit of stat diving and everything. That Bulls team, as a team, shot 41% from the field the whole series, the whole game, the whole six game series, which isn't great. Michael, fair enough, he averaged 27 points a game. But he only shot 41% from the field. Scottie Pippen had a horrendous shooting season, series. He shot 34% from the field, 15 points a game. You know, Dennis Rodman got 7.5 points a game without breaking a sweat. You know, he wouldn't have had one play drawn up for him or anything like that. Average nearly 15 rebounds for that series. Two times in that series, in Game 2 and Game 6, sets an NBA Finals record for offensive rebounds in an NBA Finals game. Twice! In Game 2 and Game 6. You know, and you go back and that the Seattle team shoots better from the field. You know, Sean Kemp averages 23-10 for the series. Gary Payton averages 18-7 assists. But they had no help.
No. Correct.
They had no help. They had no depth. They didn't get anything from Detlef Schrempf. Hersey Hawkins was a good defensive guard, but you weren't going to get a whole lot of offense out of him. And Frank Bukowski, who was the starting center, you were just going to get nothing from him. Like, Dennis Rodman tortured him that whole series. Like, tortured him. It was unbelievable. It was great. Yeah, it was just a strange series, and it just felt so dominant by the Bulls to win in six games, and as it turns out, the game clincher in Chicago, the game six is on Father's Day.
On Father's Day, yeah, correct. So it sort of came a little bit full circle, I guess it really did, and. God, didn't he show it too after they won that game six, the emotions that poured out of him.
Oh, man, that must have just been such relief, such joy, you know, just everything had come out of him. He grabs the ball, he's rolling around on the court, he's getting mobbed by everybody, but you just feel that he wanted that moment alone, and he ends up getting it in the locker room, you know, lying on the ground, hugging the ball. He gets that moment alone and he sort of pours his emotions out in the post game press conference and everything as well, you know, thanks the family and, you know, pretty much, yeah, says that it's unbelievably special for this day to happen on Father's Day.
Yeah.
That his dad's watching down on him and, you know, this is for dad, you know, that's just the sort of emotion that even in the first three championships, you didn't really sort of see. This is a different kind of emotion that he had.
Correct. It did. It was even him looking back at it too. You could just, I don't know. Yeah, it was highly, highly emotional. It was just like I said. It was a perfect storm of Father's Day back in Chicago. You know, back to winning the way Michael Jordan does. So, it ended up finishing really, I don't know, it finished, fast forward again, just like this whole thing
been doing. Just abruptly.
That's what I mean. It felt very abrupt. It fast forward again, like this whole series has been doing back and forth. But it flash forward to the 98 Eastern Conference Finals, where the Indiana Pacers were ready to so-called dethrone a dynasty.
That's right.
This is coming from a Reggie Miller. Basically, he said they were considered the best at the time, but I feel to this day that we were the better team.
He feels that they had more depth. You know, that's right. That they actually had the better team in that 1998 conference final. So, and it was like I said, it was the last time that anybody had taken Michael Jordan to a game seven. Like that series went seven games. Obviously, he never went. He never let any NBA Finals games go seven games. But that was their tougher series. And not to say that Utah weren't tough in the two preceding finals before that. Like they said that Indiana team was absolutely their toughest test.
And he basically, in his head, he said it was a perfect storm of Michael, you know, whispers of Michael retiring, how good our team was, and he goes, all right, this is it. You're going to retire Michael Jordan, he was saying to himself.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, he's got to get himself up somehow as well, you know what I mean? Like, self-motivation as well.
Correct. Yeah, you've got it. Yeah. I mean, as any player, you've got to be motivated by something, so, correct.
Reggie'd been around a long time.
It
it finished. It was great. It was great. Like how I was going to lead into it, but it just abruptly sort of just went, "Yep, okay, we'll go back to Indiana." Right, yeah. Just finished.
You didn't expect it. You didn't expect it. You just want. You just. It was one of those episodes where you just like, I just want more, and then all of a sudden, up come the credits. You're like, "Damn it!"
Well, basically, how I sort of see it is that I mean, a lot of the episode 9 is going to be on that Eastern Conference Finals, and then 10's clearly going to be the NBA Finals. So, they might chop and change a little bit, obviously.
They'll go back and forth a little bit. They might go through that 96-97 season where, they probably didn't play their best, still have a terrific season, but, there's players that are injured, suspended as they go through like that. But, it's certainly going to focus more on this Indiana team and then the NBA Finals against the Utah Jazz.
Yeah, I think a lot on this on Indiana team, like you've sort of said, because it was a really, really good series of everything I remember about it. It was such a great series. Only because of being a big Reggie Miller fan, just his shooting and
back in the day I had a Reggie Miller jersey. I love Reggie Miller.
Well, that'll do it for this week's Final Play podcast. Don't forget you can follow us on Twitter. We've probably said Twitter heaps tonight, so that's a good segue. At the Final Play Pod. And at Final Play Pod. I keep saying that. It's at Final Play Pod, everyone. Facebook's the Final Play Podcast. That's pretty straightforward to find. We're still streaming on Podbean, Spotify, SoundCloud. Trying to get over everywhere, but basically.
Except Apple.
Except Apple, but that's a different story that we'll talk about another time. I'm assuming we're still on Gimco.
Correct. We asked. Everything's uploaded on Gimco as well. So you can get us on that platform as well. Check us out there on Gimco, Gimko. So you can get us. You can get all of our recent stuff on Gimco. So. Yeah, check us out. Check them out. Give them a like on Facebook and check out Eureka Sports Cards as well on Facebook.
Well, my name's Jason, missing Luke Longley Smith. I've been holding on.
That's another one as well. Actually, just before we go, an interesting little nugget that I got from the after show podcast with Jalen Jacoby. This is what happened on draft night in 1993. Jalen Rose is drafted by the Denver Nuggets. Apparently, Jerry Krause calls Jalen Rose, wants to get some information on him. What do you know about Sean Kemp? All of this sort of stuff. And it's just like, what's going to happen here? And he basically said to him, we're going to swap picks with Chicago. So Denver and Chicago are going to swap draft picks. We're going to draft you to the Chicago Bulls in 1993. So he would have been playing with Scottie Pippen. And we're going to trade Scottie Pippen for Sean Kemp.
Wow.
And that's out of the mouth of Jalen Rose.
Wow. Sean Kemp.
How much would that have been
and
different?
Michael Jordan.
Well, to me, they'd obviously moved on from Michael Jordan's this at Rado. So let's move on from Scottie Pippen. Let's move on from Scottie Pippen as well. So could you imagine Sean Kemp in his prime playing in a Chicago Bulls jersey with Jalen Rose?
Yeah, wow.
Unreal.
No. Well, I'd say Jordan because he would
have came. Because Jalen Rose is on that Indiana team.
Yeah. There's a thousand, Jordan probably, if that happened, Jordan probably wouldn't have came back. I'm just picturing him with Sean Kemp. My God.
That's crazy. Sean Kemp, prime Sean Kemp. Not like Sean Kemp playing for the Cavaliers where he's like fat and, sort of can't jump anymore. But prime Sean Kemp.
Destroyed every dunk destroyed the basket.
Destroyed so many lives, put so many people on posters, like it was unbelievable.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, no, that was one thing that I took out of the post show interviews and everything. Like, that was just, that's madness.
Wow. Clearly that didn't pan out, but yeah, wow, that's interesting.
That's wrong.
All right, well, have a good week, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Two more episodes left, 9 and 10. So yeah, tune into us next week. We'll give you all the juicy stuff from this from the last two episodes, which kind of makes it a little bit sad that this journey is going to be over, but a new journey will be beginning on May 28 when Rugby League is back.
Definitely back.
Just give it all to me now.
It's definitely going to be back. So this is going to tie in perfectly. One more week, and then we'll probably have that little bit of break, and then straight into
straight into football.
Yeah,
fantastic.
That time.
Couldn't have timed this perfect.
It's going to be we'll finish up with it, but it's just going to be interesting. So if they're going to be the first professional sport to go,
first team sport.
Team sport. There is a Japanese, the J League or the K League going as well, but I guess
Korean baseball's back.
A first contact sport.
Yeah. Contact
sport to go. Yeah. It'll be interesting.
Playing soccer in Belarus.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how other sports going, like the NFL, the NBA, all that, how they're going to fall in line now with it. But I guess
I don't think too much is going to happen in America at the moment.
Yeah, no, they've got a few more.
They got more issues. Yeah, we've got a lot less issues than what they got going over there. Right. We got a much better chance of getting organized team sports happening in this country.
Have a good week, everyone.
All right, see ya.
Yeah, no, that's.